I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are tuned to KBOO in Portland, where the time is now 9:02, and time for the Old Mole Variety Hour. We call this program the Old Mole after Karl Marx's image of the revolution, that force that works invisibly underground to survey and undermine the foundations of a society based on the private control of social wealth, the society called capitalism. As a recent piece on the Jacobin magazine website argues, it's time to look beyond liberal reformist parties whose only platform is that we should vote for them because the Republicans are scary. Yes, the Republicans are scary, but what voters want is a vision of a truly better society. We the people want to believe that there can be a better world, that through collective endeavor we can as a people feed our poor, care for our sick, and find at least some better balance between our rapacity and the health of our planet. I'm your host for today's Old Mole, Clayton Morgridge, and Patsy Kullberg is our engineer. On today's Old Mole, we're going to look at some things that the U.S. has done to rattle the cage and the nerves of the leaders of North Korea that might explain that nation's hostility. We'll hear a discussion of the central role of the police and the military in preventing the radical social change the world needs now. I'll have some words about the real problem of inequality, and Fran Michel will have some thoughts about the role of race in the new Hulu version of The Handmaid's Tale. If you like what you hear and want to hear any part of it again or recommend it to your friends, today's show will be up on the KBOO website in the next day or two. That's kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. Well, first up today, the Old Mole's Lori Mercier is here to talk with Marty Hart Landsberg about Korea and U.S. relations with North Korea. Lori.
Thanks, Clayton. Marty Hart Landsberg is Professor Emeritus of Economics at Lewis and Clark College and author of numerous publications about capitalist globalization and the popular blog Reports from the Economic Front. He's also worked extensively on the political economy of East Asia and specifically Korea, which is why we're talking to him today. His many publications on Korea include the books South Korea and the Global Economy, Korea, Division, Reunification, and U.S. Foreign Policy, and Rush to Development, Economic Change and Political Struggle in South Korea. He is also board member of the Korea Policy Institute. Welcome back to KBOO and the Old Mole, Marty.
Oh, I'm delighted to be here with you.
Well, President Trump's belligerency towards North Korea is distressing, but perhaps more disturbing is the mainstream media's reporting that lacks any historical context and is almost universally in favor of the confrontational approach adopted by both Trump and his predecessor, Barack Obama. Although Kim Jong-un is portrayed as a crazy dictator, there's no mention of the long history of U.S. military provocations on the peninsula. So, Marty, give us some background on how U.S. administrations have behaved towards North Korea over the past three or four decades. That helps explain where we are in terms of these heightened tensions today.
Well, thanks for that good frame. Let me just start by saying that the tensions that exist right now between U.S. and North Korea are very real, but they're not new. And to go back a little bit in that history, the U.S. began, even leaving aside the Korean War, began conducting war games with South Korean forces in 1976, and it wasn't long before those included simulated nuclear attacks against the North. And that was before the North had any nuclear weapons. In 1994, President Bill Clinton was very close to launching a military attack on North Korea. In fact, the president of South Korea at the time has told the news that he begged on the phones to keep Bill Clinton from doing this attack. In 2002, President Bush talked about seizing North Korean ships and blockading the entire country, which would have been an act of war. In 2013, the U.S. conducted war games involving first strikes on North Korean military targets and included plans for decapitation, that was their word, of the North Korean leaders, again practiced nuclear attacks. Now, I don't think we're on the verge of a new Korean War, but every time the U.S. sort of does this, the North responds, of course, with its threats to attack U.S. bases in the region and increasingly even, you know, claims that it will attack the U.S. But what's happening is the cycle of belligerency and threat-making is intensifying. And although I don't think we're on the verge of a new Korean War, the possibility of miscalculation that could trigger a war is there, and it grows. And there's nothing to play around with. And I think this is also an important point, that even if war is averted, that all of a sudden people, you know, on both sides step back, the tensions that surround U.S. foreign policy with North Korea come with high costs. The tensions have provided cover for militarism to grow in Japan. Japan is now moving away from its peacetime constitution, which forbade an army. Militarism is growing in China. The militarism has affected democratic possibilities in South Korea. It's certainly adding to the embargo and tightening of economic conditions in North Korea, hurting the well-being of people in North Korea. So this is a very serious thing.
And with this growing militarism, I mean, you mentioned that Clinton had threatened war in 94, but also the Clinton administration did broker a deal with North Korea that actually worked for some time. And so why is it that strategy of negotiation is not often pursued?
So it's not only not pursued, but as you said at the very beginning, we don't really hear from that. I mean, the media portrays North Korea as a hermit kingdom. They don't want any contact, and that they're ruled by crazy people hell-bent on war, and that they can't be trusted to follow through on their promises. And let me just sort of touch on those and use the agreement that the Clinton administration eventually approved as an example of some of this. First, the North has been asking for direct talks with the U.S. since the early 1990s, and the reason is simple. When the Soviet Union ended and Russia and other Central European countries moved to adopt capitalism, the North was left in a very bad situation. All of its trade had gone there, so now it couldn't import goods because it couldn't sell goods, and it had no longer a military protector. So the North decided that they had to reconnect to the global economy, and to do that, they had to normalize relations with the U.S. The Korean War has never ended. There's no peace treaty. There's no normalization of relations between the North Korea and the U.S. or North Korea and Japan. And the North has tried to join the IMF and the World Bank, and the U.S. and Japan have vetoed them. The North has tried to set up free trade zones to attract foreign investment, but the U.S. and Japan have blocked that. So the North keeps asking for talks. They want to sit down with the U.S., direct talks, all issues on the table, and the U.S. refuses. It always sets preconditions on these talks. And so now we get to the question of the North's nuclear program that seems to be the justification for all the kind of aggressive actions that the U.S. takes. The North began a small nuclear program for research in the late 1980s. But the nuclear question didn't arise until the early 90s when the Soviet Union disappeared and the North no longer had any military protection. And the U.S. claimed that the North was developing nuclear weapons. And the North said, well, we're not going to confirm or deny, but if you will negotiate with us, we will we'll reveal everything. And we're happy to do away with this nuclear program. And the Clinton administration refused. It said, in fact, you need to open up now. We want to be able to inspect everything that's going on. And the North said no. And the Clinton administration prepared, in fact, military strikes. And the only reason they were averted is that Jimmy Carter flew to North Korea against the desires of the Clinton administration, met Kim Il-sung, and produced an agreement where the North would freeze its programs, allow all of its nuclear fuel to be kept under wraps and inspected by the International Atomic Energy Agency, and in exchange, the U.S. would agree to provide new fuel, new light water reactors, which didn't have military use, and normalized relations. And so from 1994 to 2002, the North Koreans froze their facilities, didn't produce any plutonium. All of its fuel was kept under wraps, but the U.S. did not follow through. The U.S. didn't build the new light water reactors. The U.S. did not ship heavy fuel, and the U.S. didn't move forward for normalization movements. And in 2001, we know that George Bush was elected. He called the North Korea part of Axis of Evil, and in 2002 threatened an embargo. So the North said, okay, if that's what we're going to do, we're going to start up our reactors, and we're going to start moving towards nuclear weapons. And this has been sort of the history here, that the North is desperate to get the U.S. to sit down and negotiate with them around normalization of relations, and the U.S. refuses. And so what happens is the North says, what do we need to do to get the U.S. to do this? Because we can't, the North can't just accept the status quo, which comes with these embargoes, which has led to a shrinking of its economy. And every time the U.S. offers something, the North accepts. When the U.S. backs off, the North increases. And that's been key for every one of its nuclear tests. The nuclear tests have come after the U.S. has backed off agreements, has tightened sanctions in an attempt to pull the U.S. into negotiations.
So it seems like, Marty, that in contrast to the portrayal of North Korea as being crazy and in need of check by the U.S. and Japan, that really it has behaved in a very logical fashion based on the responses to the United States' actions. And as you have written, there's no big mystery about what North Korea wants.
Exactly. They are desperate economically to start their economy up. And, you know, we talk about North Korea as this military power, but it's since 1976, South Korea has outspent the North on military every single year. The total military budget of North Korea is $4 billion. South Korea, $40 billion, and that does not include what the U.S. contributes in terms of its military profile. The North has always been responding to militarism that surrounded it. The reason people keep talking about it as a big military power is because there's a high percentage of its budget going to the military, but that's because it's up against both a richer South Korea and a richer, more powerful U.S. So the fact is that we have an option here. We don't need to be pursuing the war. You asked before, why is this happening? Well, there's a very powerful military-industrial complex. The U.S. likes having troops on the Asian mainland. It gives the U.S. the ability to maintain some kind of authority and control within the region with Japan, to become aggressive towards China. So there are powerful forces that keep pushing. And the options are there. We need to get a movement in the United States that says to the U.S., we need to sit down and negotiate without preconditions with the North, which has time and time again said, if you stop your war games, we'll stop nuclear testing. If you move towards normalization, we're willing to get rid of our, you know, end our missile programs. So the ability, very simply, to bring this to a different direction is there. We have powerful political forces which aren't willing to accept those offers.
Marty, we just have a couple of minutes, but let's talk briefly about South Korea, because much has been made about the French presidential election,
yes,
but hardly anything about the South Korean elections to be held tomorrow. So is there a possibility that South Koreans, who almost universally oppose U.S. acceleration of tensions there, could play a role in altering relations with the North?
I think this is a very important development. The election tomorrow, most likely a man named Moon Jae-in will be elected. He's sort of a liberal, but he, like many South Koreans, is horrified by what the U.S. is doing now and has done in the past. And he has pledged to reopen negotiations. South Korea has been ruled by very right-wing leaders who have been working with the U.S. to kind of put pressure on the North, hoping to collapse it. I think this could be a reversal of that policy, and I think it will make it more difficult for the U.S. to keep pushing. So I think if we begin pushing in the United States a new policy, we're going to have an ally in South Korea. South Koreans fear U.S. policy towards the North much more than they fear the North. They realize that no one would escape a new war on the Korean Peninsula. So they're not afraid of North Korea. They're afraid of what U.S. policy means. And if Moon is elected, I think that the dynamics in that region will change.
And we don't hear from South Korean voices or any Korean voices in the U.S. media, but certainly there have been more critical voices about U.S. intentions in the region. In fact, many commentators in South Korea have noted that the reason for U.S. tensions are to support the U.S. military-industrial complex.
Not only that, but, you know, these tensions work just like in the U.S. when suddenly there's a fear of terrorism. It tends to shift politics to the right. It gives governments the ability to suppress opponents across the board. It's worked that way in South Korea as well. The U.S. has worked to keep very conservative, right-wing, more often than not, military governments in power. And they do that when they ramp up these tensions. It allows those governments under national security law to suppress unions, to suppress people on the left who have alternative visions. So it's not only the U.S. military-industrial complex, but it's maintaining networks of allies that are willing to follow U.S. policy. So if the South can elect someone who's willing to resist this, you know, this could be an important way to begin to change things. And I would say, you know, things change very rapidly, and I'd like to just mention three websites that people can go to.
Great.
That are very helpful to keep up on things. One is the Korea Policy Institute site, which is kpolicy.org. Another is zoominkorea.org, which does a lot of reporting, including comments and insights from people in South Korea. And the last one is called stopfad.org. That's stop, T-H-A-A-D.org, which refers to a THAAD missile system that the U.S. is forcing in on South Korea 2 or 3 days before the election against the wishes of South Korean people, and is stirring a greater anti-Americanism than we've seen in decades there.
Well, thanks so much, Marty Hart Landsberg, and we'll try to post those websites on the Old Mole Variety Hour website. And thanks again for joining us.
Oh, I really appreciate you giving me the opportunity.
Hey, look yonder, tell me what you see. Marching to the fields of Korea. Looks like handsome Johnny with an M1 in his hand. Marching to the Korean War. Hey, marching to the Korean War. And it's a long, hard road. It's a long, hard road.
And that's from Richie Havens' song Handsome Johnny, following up on Marty Hart Landsberg's conversation with Laurie Mercier about Korea and the U.S. today. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Clayton Margridge. Later in the show, I'll have some commentary about the real problem of inequality. Inequality is not just an inequality of income and quality of life, but an inequality of power that constitutes domination. And you won't want to miss Fran Michel's upcoming discussion of the role of race in casting The Handmaid's Tale, the new TV series from Hulu. But right now, Bill Resnick is in the studio to talk with Wael El-Assadi about getting the police to respect civil liberties as well as the role of the police in preventing radical social transformation. Bill.
Thank you, Clayton. Wael El-Assadi, welcome to KABU.
Thanks for having me.
And fairly recently, a host of
One Land, Many Voices.
One Land, Many Voices.
It's been a couple of years.
Anyway, he's graduated from that to many other activist roles. He's also a writer. He co-founded Students United for Palestinian Equal Rights. He's been a longtime member of the International Socialist Organization. Recently, he helped organize the PS Portland State University May Day rally in March, joined the larger citywide May Day rally. He did a widely distributed piece on May Day, on the May Day celebration rally, titled Hard Facts About Portland's May Day Riot. The riot was, of course, in quotes. It was first published in the Socialist Worker. Wael described it as a police riot, as did most of the march organizers and marches. He also critiqued the Black Bloc in Portland for giving the police pretext to go on the attack. So, Wael, you've written on the police. You've also studied the police. You've thought about the police in relationship to revolutions. Remind us first what happened on May Day here in Portland, and then we'll turn to what I see as as the most serious question now faced by humanity and the left today. That is, how do we save the planet? How our movements must relatively soon gain political power to reconstruct our whole productive and economic system. It's a big job. And also, of course, the ways of daily living in the rich world. And that, of course, is to stop global warming. But this is much less likely to succeed if the police and military and National Guard, among others, stay loyal to capitalist elites. Anyway, Wael, tell us about May Day and the police and Black Bloc.
Sure. Yes, I think the first thing that has to be said about May Day is that there was a lot of incredible organizing that went into it. The PSU rally brought together a lot of student groups and unions at PSU that were able to rally and celebrate. And then the May Day, Portland May Day Coalition did an amazing job organizing groups around town. And about 1,500 people in total ended up rallying in Chemainsky Park with a lot of great speeches, and it was that was excellent. Now, what happened next was that the march begins with the large number of protesters chanting and going along the route. This march was permitted. The organizers had applied and gotten a permit for the march. And the police from the beginning had come heavily militarized and were in riot gear. And about halfway through the march, it appears that a few individuals from the back of the march had thrown a Pepsi can and possibly, you know, a few smoke bombs in the direction of the police as the march was proceeding along. And the police essentially used these isolated acts as cover to carry out what was essentially an all-out militarized assault on the entire May Day march. So at that point, They revoked the permit of the march. They announced this over loudspeaker. They said anyone remaining in the area would be subject to arrest and that all protesters had to leave or get on the sidewalk. And the march organizers attempted to steer people onto the sidewalk. But of course, this was Monday in downtown Portland, right around where it was very busy. Half of the people were able to fit on the sidewalks. The other half weren't. And within 5 minutes of making that announcement, the police essentially did something that was utterly reckless, which was shoot tear gas canisters and percussion sound grenades into the dense crowd of over 1,000 protesters that was downtown, as well as nearby pedestrians and residents of the city. And from there, what ensued was chaos as people essentially fled from the police and into corners. And the media, for the most part, unfortunately, has echoed the line of the police, which was that there were violent, that May Day had turned into a riot, that things were being burnt, the glass was being broken, and they had to go in to essentially subdue a riot and restore order to the city. But in reality, what happened was that there were some objects thrown by what I would call irresponsible individuals, but these were minor isolated instances from an otherwise large peaceful march that was already heading back to its destination, and that the youths used that as a propagation to essentially escalate the situation. And if there is, you know, if we can call what happened a riot, this was a riot that was essentially instigated by the Portland police and very irresponsible. We had contingents of children, disabled persons at the beginning of the march, as well as children and families dispersed throughout the march. And the police simply began to shoot tear gas into that. And it's after that that the mass of the marchers dispersed. And then what was left was a street battle, essentially, between the Black Bloc and the police.
Yeah. How do you understand what could have motivated the police to, in fact, create this riot out of what was a peaceful march? It seems to me that they've been, over the last several years, and particularly after the Battle of Seattle, the police have enormously militarized and have become seen themselves as, in much more than in the past, the protectors of property, the protectors of downtown, the people who have to disperse these marchers because who knows what they're going to do, and they are just ready to do violence. Furthermore, they select police for their squads out of those who volunteer to get in there and do battle, it seems to me, is the way it works. What do you see as the sort of the How did it come to this, that the police are operating in this way in Portland?
Well, you know, the police in this country from the very beginning, their role was to protect property. So they emerge out of essentially slave patrols in the South, and then in the cities, as a large working class begins to emerge in the cities, they are organized as a way to essentially to protect the property of the wealthy, right, from strikes, and essentially to control the mass of the people from being able to organize in public. So that's been their role really since the founding of this country, was to protect the interests of what we call today the 1%. And but what certainly has happened in the past 30 years, and that's accelerated in the past 50 years, is a high level of militarization and organization of the police. And that begins on the one hand and as part of the new Jim Crow. That is a way to roll back the movements of the 60s and essentially to criminalize a black population in this country and then go on the assault against what existed of the social safety net. The police needed to be, from the ruling class perspective, needed to be more militarized for this. So that's when you begin to see the level of weapons increase. And then this was amplified by the war on terror, by which there was, as a result of the Islamophobia, the war on terror rhetoric, there was cover provided for an outright militarization of the police. So they regularly receive they receive military gear from the military, and the budgets of militarized police equipment has increased since that time.
Yeah, and they're trained and motivated to break up marches and demonstrations. And as long as they're organized the way they are, and they have this sort of military command that puts them in motion, then they go through this the same way when they're making an arrest, 8 guys will pile on some poor person, throw them down, handcuff them, and then kick them a little bit for, I don't know, pleasure or whatever the reason. They go through their routines. And the routine is to disperse people and terrorize them. In any event, that's a real problem, though, that the police have been so socialized, in fact, and now are accepting that kind of behavior. We'll continue in this line. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Bill Resnick, talking to Wael El-Assadi. We just discussed May Day in Portland, crackdown on dissent, and the great moving rights show of the police occurring in many, many forms, including we see the great support from the police ranks for Donald Trump in the last election. This weekend, Wael and I discussed how dangerous this is today, because in the not-too-distant future, maybe 10 years, maybe 40 or 50, climate change will very likely, according to the findings of climate scientists, climate change will create a combined economic-environmental crisis that could only be ended in ways to save humanity by totally reconstructing our production system, lifeways in the rich world. And that's then going to create a great struggle between the forces of the left, who are going to fight for a democratic, sustainable system, and on the other side, the forces of the right, who will want to reconstruct on their terms, preserving their power and most of their wealth, of course. And that raises then the issue of the police and military and all the forces of repression and control, because looking at the historical record appears, at least to me, that groups seeking to replace capitalism find it extremely hard, if not impossible, to win if the police and military stay loyal to the capitalist elites, and sometimes they don't stay loyal. You thought about these questions a lot, Wael. How do we look at the police and the need for vast movements that would reconstruct our whole economic system away from the capitalist growth mania?
Yeah, it's a great and big question. I think there's a few things that have to be said right off the bat. First is the U.S. state in particular is one of the most organized and vicious states and ruling classes the world over. So I think the very first fact that we as activists on the left have to understand is that to be able to carry out anything like a social revolution that can transform the system is going to require the participation of masses of people, and not the activities of a self self-appointed minority, you know, who's going to do it on our behalf. And so I think the question of how do we engage with masses of people who right now are angry about the bigotry of Trump and help to actually bring more people in the streets, more people in the political organization, because it will take a much larger number than we have right now to be able to even conceive of a challenge to this system. And of course, there's the question of, you know, of then the social force that has the power. And I'll say it briefly, my feelings that it'll take the organized capacity of what are the vast majority of people who work in this country to be able to essentially shut down their greatest power, which is profit, to be able to do this. And that's why I'll say the Black Bloc tactics that are carried out are unproductive, because what they do is they elevate a tactic to the level of a principle and then carry out regardless of the situation or political context. And I think that in this particular situation in Portland, what it did was it placed people in danger unnecessarily. B, it actually ends up isolating the left from the larger number of people who do want to engage in struggle but are not, you know, ready to engage in fights in the police. And then three, I think it was undemocratic. There was a conversation that happened with the march organizers, which asked that this would be a safe space because we wanted immigrants, children, families to participate in this event. And unfortunately, the democratic decisions of the organizers were not carried out. So I think this opens up a question of strategy and tactics in our movement that we really do have to carry out.
Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole, talking to Wael El Asadi on how to somehow neutralize the police. Well, what we're going to have to do, Wael, I think we only have another minute. My sense is that you're absolutely right. It's going to take a great mass movement, but that great mass movement could be defeated by genocidal police if they ever get to that. And I think part of our role is to, in some ways, neutralize the police, split the police. The police and the military, and their different organizations, have different interests than their bosses. Now, their bosses are our enemy. The police are just the agents of the enemy, but they also have different interests. I think it's possible to split them away such that they will not turn their guns on the people. That's happened before. And I think another time we're going to have to talk about how to do that. At least it's more likely that we will win if we split the police and military. So you've got the last word.
I'll just say very briefly, I think that's possible if we look at history in regards to the military because of their class composition and the short stints they place in the military. I think that is impossible with the police. They are trained, organized ideologically to essentially maintain order and attack the working class and oppressed in this country. So the question is not whether we can split them, but rather can we actually cohere the social power to be able to defeat their repression?
Well, that's part of the way of splitting them. They decided that it's more costly than and better to work with these movements than to obey their bosses. But that's another discussion, and it's a very interesting discussion. Thanks a lot for talking to us, Wael El Asadi.
Thank you, Bill.
Right.
And that's Mr. Policeman, a song from Rick James' 1981 album Street Songs. And before that, we heard Wael El Asadi talking with Bill Resnick about the role of police in maintaining order. That's the existing order. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO. I'm Clayton Morgridge. Well, what is that existing order that is protected by the police? Well, it's an order of inequality. And what's wrong with inequality? Here is my commentary on that. The contrast of affluence and wretchedness, continually meeting and offending the eye, is like dead and living bodies chained together. That's a quote from Thomas Paine in the 18th century. And that contrast, of course, is still with us. Take a drive through Dunthorpe or the West Hills, and then drive through the outer reaches of East Portland and past homeless encampments scattered around town. Or just think of Trump's 3 floors of luxury living space in Trump Tower, a few minutes away from slums in Newark and the South Bronx. We can get a more global picture of this gap from facts like the following, which come from an article on Alternet. The amount of money that was given out just in bonuses on Wall Street last year is twice the amount that all minimum wage workers earned in the country combined. Just 8 men, from Bill Gates to Michael Bloomberg, own as much wealth as 3.6 billion people, according to an analysis by Oxfam. The poorest half of the Earth's population owns just 1% of the Earth's wealth, but the richest 1% of the Earth's population owns 46% of the Earth's wealth. And things are not getting any better. The slice of the national income pie going to the wealthiest 1% of Americans has doubled since 1979. Now, what exactly is wrong with the existence of this gap between the wealthy few and the rest of us? Is it just that it's unfair that some people should have so much when so many have so little? Surely there's no way that the few wealthy people contribute so much more to the common good that they deserve to have so much. Nor is it possible that the many do so little that they deserve nothing or nearly nothing by comparison. But are we just complaining because of envy, like the envy I might feel for someone who's taller or better looking than I am? If so, then the reply might be, life is unfair, suck it up. The stark contrast between wealth and poverty is often called obscene. That's what's implied by Thomas Paine's image of living and dead bodies chained together and offending the eye. Why should the existence of great wealth next to squalid poverty disgust us? Well, it's partly because human misery by itself is a disgusting degradation of human life. But more than that, we're offended by the utter indifference of wealthy people to that misery, to the suffering of so many others. But the very rich have a very powerful motive for their indifference, for taking that great gulf between themselves and the poor as a fact of nature, as the result of just their natural superiority over ordinary people, and therefore something for which they need have no concern or take no responsibility. They think this in order not to see or to admit that they need the world's poverty in order that they can be rich. They are naturally predisposed to take their superior status for granted, just as those who profited from chattel slavery came to regard white supremacy as the natural order of things. Yes, the rich and the poor are obscenely chained together, but the chains belong to the few and are worn by the many. For the rich exploit the lives and labor of the many, and that's what makes them rich. The owners of the world suck value out of the lives of the rest of us in many ways. The most obvious is through wage labor. The profits of Walmart, Apple, General Motors, Kroger, and Cargill, and the profits of all their suppliers, are produced by the labor of their employees, people who have no way to live but by selling their lives by the hour or the week or the month to those who have capital they can use to pay wages. But there are many other ways that massive wealth in the form of capital comes to grow and grow and get larger. Consider the healthcare system. Pete Carman in These Times offers a succinct explanation of how the U.S. healthcare system works. The U.S. healthcare system is unique in the world because it is based on the private investor's desire to increase market penetration and profit. Return on investment is enhanced by charging the highest possible price for health insurance while paying out the lowest possible benefits. For pharmaceuticals, Americans are charged the highest prices in the world.
An inherent advantage of our health sector for the investor is that nearly everyone will pay out their last dime to keep themselves and their loved ones alive and well. Providers are therefore free to charge whatever the lust for life will bear. Insurance companies, in other words, are answerable to the financial sector, whose only interest is in the increase of their capital. Capital goes where there is the most profit to be made, and if an industry fails to do well at the profit-making business, capital will go elsewhere, and the industry fails or is bought up by someone or some group of investors who will cut costs and services and wages to make it more profitable. This makes the whole medical-industrial complex a machine for generating profits for Wall Street. The same goes for nearly everything else that this economy produces: food, housing, transportation, entertainment, the media, and increasingly what used to be public services like education, water, postal services, and retirement. Even government, though it advertises itself as a servant and protector of the people, exists primarily to serve and protect capital, which means defending the rich against the poor, who are exploited as workers and as consumers in nearly every moment in their lives. Too many people seem to think that if we could only get powerful people in government, business, and the media to understand what's wrong with inequality, what's obscene about it, then they would change their ways and do something about it. But that's expecting them to give up what they feel is their birthright privilege, the right to live without working, because the rest of us work for them. The fight for single-payer health insurance is a step towards depriving capital of the power to enrich themselves from our illnesses and injuries. We must extend that struggle to depriving capital of the power to decide the way that every part of our lives is produced and reproduced, and that would mean the abolition of capitalism altogether, the abolition of the right to own the conditions of our lives. I'm Clayton Morgridge for the Old Mole Variety Hour. And that's Gotta Go to Work by the Bottle Rockets, a song about how the lives of workers are dominated by wage labor. The song goes on and on, repeating itself. Next up on the Old Mole, our well-read red, Fran Michel, has some critiques gathered from the left press of the Hulu series, The Handmaid's Tale.
Among the literary portraits of American fascism garnering renewed interest since last November, Margaret Atwood's 1985 novel, The Handmaid's Tale, is probably the best known. Indeed, its nightmare of reproductive injustice is so familiar that signs at the Women's March earlier this year could simply allude to it, with slogans like, "Make Margaret Atwood Fiction Again," or "Noliti de Pastardes Carborundorum," also a popular tattoo. Activists in Texas recently protested proposed further restrictions on abortion access by dressing as handmaids. The novel has been variously banned, translated, and adapted, including multiple dramatic adaptations for radio and stage, a ballet and opera, a 1990 feature film, and most recently, a 10-episode series on Hulu. I'll avoid spilling details about most of the ways the current television version departs from the novel, but I don't think that knowing the story's basic situation detracts from the impact of either the book or the series. So, mild spoilers ahead. The Handmaid's Tale describes a near-future American theocracy in which environmental pollution has led to widespread infertility. The patriarchal regime that takes over portions of the United States and renames it Gilead imposes a totalizing system that dictates clothing, ritual, and family structure. The few women who are still fertile are assigned as handmaids to the families of powerful commanders and their wives. Publicity for the series has stressed its timeliness while acknowledging its updating. But while many of the inevitable changes from the book work well, displacing and condensing elements for clarity and visual impact, dramatizing moments unrepresented in the novel, and elaborating on the experiences of secondary characters, one problematic change has been evident since the previews revealed the protagonist's friend Moira is played by Samira Wiley. The attempt to make the setting post-racial runs counter to the political history of the United States, the details of the novel, and the ostensible goals of the change. Among the small number of writers to critique this choice, I'm drawing here on points from Susan Rensing on Nursing Cleo, Soraya McDonald on The Undefeated, Priya Nair in Bitch Magazine, and blog posts on Fangs for the Fantasy and by Aberdeen Dadaboy. In the novel, the Gilead theocracy is racist as well as sexist and homophobic. The excuse for the imposition of martial law that leads to the Gilead takeover is a supposed threat of Islamic terrorism. African Americans are relocated to the Midwest to homelands imagined as resembling those of the apartheid era in South Africa. Dissidents of various sorts are either executed, their hanged bodies often displayed for days as a warning to others, or sent to clean up the toxic wastelands known as the colonies, apparently a slightly slower sort of death sentence. But only white women become handmaids. Some critics have faulted the novel for this. The book gets some of its frisson from imposing on white women some of the oppressions imposed on enslaved black women in the antebellum South, and the tropes and imagery of U.S. chattel slavery. Women in Gilead are forbidden to read, write, or congregate. They're treated as property, valued for their reproductive capacity, named for their owners. The central character is called Offred, because her commander is named Fred, of Fred, Offred. Those escaping to Canada are helped by a secret network known as the Underground Female Road, and many of their allies are Quakers. Offred's narrative, like many 19th-century slave narratives, originates in oral form. But while Atwood's novel thus arguably obscures the intricate relation of racism and sexism by silently transposing races, centering a white woman's experience by taking what happened to African-American women under slavery and imagining a near future where white women experience forced breeding, the book does acknowledge the racism of Gilead. In the far future epilogue, an historian looking back at Gilead notes that the regime's racist policies were firmly rooted in the pre-Gilead period, and racist fears provoked some of the emotional fuel that allowed the Gilead takeover to succeed as well as it did. For the Hulu series, however, executive producer Bruce Miller decided to cut out the white supremacist ideology of the Republic of Gilead, saying that he made the decision that fertility trumped everything. But of course, concerns over the birth rate and population have always been about whose fertility and the fear of being overrun by someone else's babies. The religious right first got traction as a political movement not in trying to stop abortions, but in trying to stop racial integration. White supremacist groups worry that interracial marriage constitutes white genocide because it taints Aryan purity. Stormfront and similar sites fret about whites being outbred by non-whites, and the Quiverful movement encourages Christian white women to breed incessantly. So the change is implausible in relation to the racism of real history. And it's implausible to suggest that it presents a post-racial world. As Aberdeen Dadaboy points out, if this were truly a world devoid of white supremacy, would all of the wives of the commanders be icy blondes or pale gingers? Compounding this is the fact that other than Moira, the other black and brown bodies are both scarce and light-skinned. In fact, if fertility did trump everything, then I suspect we'd see a lot more brown people than we do. It's not as though there's evidence white women are more fertile than others. At the very least, we'd see equal distribution of races within the ranks of the handmaids. Finally, the lingering and loving gaze of the camera lets us know how much the narrative is invested in white suffering and white pain. We're treated to long close-ups of delicate white faces forced to wince and blink at unspeakable atrocities. It's their pain we're asked to witness and with which we should identify. We're asked to identify with the suffering of these women on a fundamental level, on a universal level, on a human level. In trying to rationalize the series' casting choices, producer Miller asks, "What's the difference between making a TV show about racists and making a racist TV show?" Why would we be covering the story of Handmaid Offred rather than telling the story of the people of color who get sent off to the Midwest? I want to suggest there's potentially a great deal of difference between making a TV show about racists and making a racist TV show, and the possibility that Miller presents this as a rhetorical question should cause concern. In the terms that Miller tries to set up, there is indeed no good reason that Offred herself need be played by a white woman. And since we've begun to see the series develop scenes and characters not followed in the novel, there's no good reason we would not follow those who were exiled to some homeland. But for those visions, as Priya Nair argues, we need to turn not to the work of Margaret Atwood, but to that of Octavia Butler or Octavia's brood. For the Old Mole Variety Hour, this has been Fran Michel.
That come together to stand united. The voices of toiling masses gather, our voices heightened. We want our lows lightened, we want our wrongs righted. Any attempt to control our bodies, we poised to fight it. Gon' blame the system, that's accurate. But if we claim our inaction, that's activist. Our body's not a target, yet it's under attack. Forward together, never a single step back.
Thank you, Fran Michel. And now here are a couple of events that Moles in the Ground might consider going to this week. Tomorrow, Tuesday, May 9th at 6:30 p.m. at the Old Church at Southwest 11th and Clay, Grammy-nominated local recording artist and theatrical performer Julianne Johnson will moderate We Can Listen Together, We Make a Village. The conversation will focus on recent efforts to address homelessness in Portland through a design process that brought together a range of stakeholders, including architects, activists, city agencies, and houseless individuals. They will offer their stage at the Old Church to members of Portland's homeless community, along with representatives from the Center for Public Interest Design and the POD Initiative, as they discuss the Kenton Women's Village in Northeast Portland as a model for supporting community making and strong social infrastructure among villages of houseless individuals. This event is supported in part by KABU. Next Sunday, May 14th at 2 p.m., there will be a rally to reclaim Mother's Day for peace, the mother of all protests. The aim here is to stop using the term the mother of to mean the largest of or the event to end all other events, as in the mother of all bombs. It means the origin of or one who gives birth to, as the origin of Mother's Day gave birth to this demonstration. It's co-sponsored by Women's International League for Peace and Freedom and others. This is at Portland State, Southwest Harrison and 10th, next Sunday afternoon at 2. Now, there are many more events of resistance and action on the Portland Resistance calendar on the KABU website, that's kboo.fm, as well as at pdxactivist.org. Well, that's all from the Old Mole this week. Many thanks to Marty Hart Landsberg and Lori Mercier for their illuminating discussion of U.S. relations with Korea, North and South. To Wael El Asadi and Bill Resnick for their analysis of police work in a capitalist society. And to Fran Michel for her discussion of issues of race affecting The Handmaid's Tale. I'm Clayton Morgridge. Our engineer has been Patsy Kullberg. Remember, you can hear this show or any other edition of The Old Mole by going to kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. Today's show will be up in a day or two. And you can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Join us again next Monday for more news, views, reviews, and interviews from The Old Mole's underground perspective. Now, stay tuned to KABU. Thanks, KABU members, for your generous support. If you're not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate.